To him everybody was a sinner, and his fixed ideas on earth had been carried over with him. After he had finished, I was told by the next who spoke that he would have to undergo a special course of teaching, and that in time his mind would develop sufficiently to enable him to see the truth. As I say, the main essentials of all true religion remain. This new revelation takes nothing from the desires of mankind, and adds enormously to our knowledge of both this world and the next. We are all gainers by these new truths, and we lose nothing. Let us therefore live true, upright, good and unselfish lives, remembering that it is not believing creeds that matters but what we are and do. No repeating of creeds or prayers will give us any better place hereafter, as, though such repetitions give a measure of comfort, they do not make us better men and women. What is essential is the development of our character, and this is not strengthened if we are afraid to think for ourselves, and use either creeds or a book or a church as crutches, when we have sufficient knowledge before us today to enable us to walk alone. In all my communications with those who have passed on, when touching on deeper problems, I have been impressed by their insistence on the reality of their world, and how they look on this world of ours as but a poor imitation of theirs. The etheric is the basis of all life, and to the etheric will it return. What we see is temporal, and it is the unseen that is eternal, as the seen and tangible are but the results of invisible causes. In nature nothing is lost. Life may cease to manifest in a physical garb, but neither life nor its covering is lost. Life pursues its course, entering and passing through matter, which, during its passage, it endows with form and movement. When this covering ceases to fulfill its requirements, life leaves it to die and decay, returning it to Mother Earth, whence it came, so that it may be used again for the passage of life at some future date. Life but gathers. 137. Within this physical covering, so as to enable it to assume form, and in the more highly developed creatures this form persists in the etheric world. This earth is just an incubator, developing life during its passage through the physical. It is but the nursery of the human race, its place of preparation for the real and enduring world which is to us, in the physical body, both intangible and unsensed. The great law which governs this etheric world is that of harmony, or the law of attraction, similar to our law of gravitation. As the physical body is subject to the latter, so the etheric is subject to the former. There, like attracts like, and, on arrival in the new environment, I am told that we are irresistibly drawn into that company and condition for which we are fitted by character. Congenial souls keep together, but progress is always possible even for the worst if the desire is strong enough. All can ultimately progress, if they wish to, though the way for the selfish is lonely and dreary. Our thoughts and actions, therefore, here on earth are building for us our place in the hereafter. How many of us realize that thoughts are lasting things, that they pass on with us through death, and will be our companions, to influence us in an even greater degree than they now. When separated from the physical body, they assume shape and form more potent for good or evil than when clothed by the earthly body. What I have stated in this chapter is based on the information I have been given by those who once, like us, lived here on earth. In many ways they have proved to me their identity, and, in ways I could prove, they have satisfied me of their honesty and truthfulness. Why, therefore, should I not also accept their statements of the kind of life they live, the appearance of their world, and their moral and philosophical teachings? They are one stage further on than we are, and see things from a new and larger angle. If what they tell me appeals to my reason, am I to discard it as of no value because the method of communication is not in general practice? Such an argument would have killed the telephone, the telegraph and wireless at their birth, as because of their novelty no messages would have been believed, and thus they would have been useless from the start. Constant repetition, however, proved their value, just as the constant repetition of messages, which have been going. 138. On between the two worlds for the past 80 years, has confirmed in all essential details this great new revelation of a world about and around us, its life and its character. What has been told to me has been told to others, not once, but thousands of times. I am but adding another stone to the cairn, which someday will rise so high that all mankind will be forced to look upon it and believe. Chapter 15 Facts We Ought to Know. Facts are to the mind what food is to the body. On the due digestion of the former depend the strength and wisdom of the one, just as vigor and health depend on the other. The wisest in counsel, the ablest in debate, and the most agreeable companion in the commerce of human life, is that man who has assimilated to his understanding the greatest number of facts. Burke. We are all bound for another country. If we were told we would have to leave England and take up our permanent residence, let us say, in some little known part of South America, how anxious we would be to meet someone who had been there. Would we not ply him with questions, not only about the scenery and the climate, but about the kind of clothes we should take with us? When I had this opportunity with those who had returned to me from the etheric world, to which we all are traveling, I naturally took every opportunity to find out about this place, its inhabitants, its scenery and how best I could clothe my character so that I should be most suitably fitted for my new environment. Having thus learned something of our destiny, let me, in as simple terms as possible, set down these facts we ought each one of us to know. To those uninterested in the future life, to those who prefer to enter it ignorant and unprepared, this book will not appeal. All know that death must come, and those who wish to meet it with knowledge and understanding will find here food for thought. Here in this world our bodies are dual, physical, which we can see and touch, etheric, which we cannot sense with our physical organs. These two bodies interpenetrate each other. 139. But the etheric is the permanent, enduring one, the etheric mind being the abode of our memory, personality, and all those qualities which make up our character. Those qualities pertain to the etheric. The mind never grows old, only the brain, the mind's instrument, which becomes impaired as the physical body grows old. Nothing we have learned, no intellectual wealth acquired, is ever lost. Here we lose, in time, the power of expression, but this is due to the physical instrument ceasing to function with its aforetime precision. When, after the death change, the worn-out garment is laid aside, we stand, clothed in an etheric body, in our new abode. Freed from the limitations of the physical, our faculties are clearer and movements more rapid. In the change we lose nothing of value, we are still ourselves in form and feature, in thought and action. Those who have lost arms or legs will have them again, as it was only the physical which was lost, and the same with all the other bodily disabilities. The physical is but the covering, it is continually wasting away and being renewed by the blood, which is another proof that there is a permanent structure to which physical matter is attached. The child who leaves this earth as such grows to manhood or womanhood, and when this stage is reached remains a fully grown developed man or woman. Old age pertains to the physical, but it is unknown in the etheric. Children in the etheric world are carefully cared for and educated, there they have their schools and colleges. In fact, the desire for knowledge is the outstanding desire of all who seek for progress, be they children or adults. And what of the old who die? Do they who live long enough to die with all the disabilities of old age retain these throughout eternity? If we could only comprehend that the etheric body never grows old, but only the physical body, this question would not be asked. When the old and tottering body is cast aside, the etheric duplicate stands erect, freed from its outward physical handicap. The old die old only in the physical sense, but enter the next life young. Age there is not measured in years, as time there differs from ours. We count our time by the revolution of a physical globe round the physical sun, but the individual mind in the etheric world obtains in time such control over the etheric body that bodily deformities can be removed and cured by thought. 140. When we leave our earth, we enter a new environment where time, such as we understand it, does not exist. Our only earthly experience of the relativity of time is during sleep. We then, in dreams, pass through experiences which, if awake, would take us years to accomplish, but when asleep they happen in a few minutes and sometimes in seconds. I have been told by my instructors in ethereal about those who left this world 1,000 years and more ago, who are only now beginning to appreciate their new surroundings. But such cases belong to those of low development in this world, who find it difficult to adjust themselves to their new conditions and environment. The man and woman of average intelligence perceives the new environment without much delay, some almost immediately, on the passing of their etheric bodies out of the physical covering, though with others it may take days or weeks, as we measure time. Our etheric body is in every respect a duplicate of our physical body. This may seem strange at first, and I found it difficult to grasp until I understood the fact that the etheric body is the real body on Earth, and that from the moment of conception it has gathered round it physical matter, slow in vibration. Otherwise it could not have functioned in the physical world owing to its finer and more rapid vibrations. The physical body is only a protective covering for the etheric during its passage through the Earth life. In reality, our real hands here are etheric hands clothed with a glove of physical matter, and so with all the other parts of our body. Our real brain is the etheric brain, through which the mind functions, and it acts through this whether we are in this world or the next. The mind acts on the etheric brain, and the etheric brain on the material covering which we call the physical brain. Those who have made the change called death can see our minds at work, and study our etheric brain working under the influence of mind in a way we cannot. They tell me that it is just like looking at a technicolor film, because the different vibrations which impinge on our eyes vibrate the mind, and it is these vibrations that we call sight and color. These pictures formed by our mind can be seen by etherians, and consequently everything we think can be read by them in the etheric world just as easily as we can read a book. 141. We are really much greater than we think we are, very much so. Our mind as expressed through the physical brain is very limited, and only when freed from the physical do we comprehend its greatness. Our earthly mind we call conscious mind, but it, and what we term the subconscious or subliminal mind, form the complete mind. Our conscious mind directs our activities in this world, but our greater mind functions in the next. We obtain only glimpses of this greater mind in the occasionally observed phenomena of telepathy, clairvoyance, clairaudience and prevision, and on these occasions the subliminal overrides the conscious for a limited time and then withdraws. Someday, as man develops, the subliminal may become more and more a dominating factor, but at this stage of our development its intrusion is sporadic and confined to the few. When we pass on, our earth memories pass with us, but slowly they fade and we are guided and governed by this greater mind which has been with us all our lives, building up our bodies, performing its inward functions, and making us what we are, though we know it not. One other important fact has been impressed on me time and again by my informants, namely that the next is a very real world, no floating on some fleecy cloud in some disembodied state which has no form or feature. Though we are men and women, just as we are here, the world spirit is only an earth term, and a bad one because it is so misleading. Not only are our etheric bodies similar in every way to our earthly ones, but they are solid, real and tangible to their owners as ours are to us. For instance, it may seem strange to be told by an inhabitant of this world of finer matter that he took pride in keeping his fingernails polished. But, as he has fingernails, why should he not be as careful of them as we are of our physical nails? Just because B has discarded the physical covering, his etheric nail becomes no less real. Let it be remembered that when we discard the physical, it becomes the unreal, and the etheric the real to our consciousness. We have much to learn concerning matter. It does not cease to exist when it becomes invisible to our physical eyes. This can be better understood by taking some water, heating it, and then observing the effect. First we have steam partially visible, then super steam invisible. By reversing the process we can bring back the invisible super. 142. Steam to water. Though invisible, the super steam is still matter. All we did was to increase its vibrations, and then reduce them until we had water again. Our etheric bodies vibrate at a frequency beyond the capacity of our physical eye to catch. But, Under certain conditions, when freed from the physical body after death, these vibrations can be lowered, and, with what is called ectoplasm borrowed from the medium, the vocal organs can again vibrate our atmosphere and speech. In recent years we have come to learn that space is not an empty void, but contains a substance we call ether. Here dwell the myriads of the so-called dead, in a world to them as material as is ours to us. This etheric world is the real world, as it forms the basis of everything we term physical. This etheric world is both a condition and a place. It encircles our Earth, as do the belts and zones round the planet Saturn, but it interpenetrates as well, as physical matter forms no part of this etheric world. Here we live within the limits of physical vibrations, there they live within the limits of the vibrations to which their etheric bodies are fitted. Everything to them is as natural as our world is to us here. They have houses, schools, churches, fields, trees, flowers, music, clothes and all the pleasures the mind desires. The family tie unites again those whom affection held together on earth. There is no working for money, and the absence of money is about the only thing different from this earth. Everything else socially is similar, as the same minds that were on earth are there and have the same ideals and ideas as they had here. There, however, they are living in a finer environment which they can mold in a manner impossible here on earth. It is mental wealth that is sought after, as our thoughts condition our environment in this next plane of consciousness to a degree unrealized here. Those of low intelligence, and of evil thought, make their conditions low and evil, whereas those of pure and high thinking have the conditions suitable to their thoughts. Hence the importance of giving due regard to the development of our character on right lines here and now, as just as we leave the physical social we enter the etheric. If we have no noble thoughts here we shall not have them there. If we go through this world like Bunyan's character, with a muckrake in our hand, looking no way but downwards. 143. We shall not be able to look upwards there. Only by undoing our errors will progress in time become possible. Why not, therefore, live here so that our progress onwards may be both steady and continuous? We are day by day making our future habitation. If our thoughts are pure we shall dwell with the pure, if evil then our abode will be with the evil. It is therefore the duty of each one, individually, to live here on earth so that his next stage on the journey may be in truth a further step on the road to the fullness of wisdom which, however many the bypaths we traverse in error, we should, if we have the desire, reach in the end. Chapter 16 Conclusion. To be perfectly just is an attribute of the divine nature. To be so to the utmost of our abilities is the glory of man. Addison. Now, I ask, what have we to make of it all? Have I been the victim of a great fraud? Has all that I have recorded, and much else, a normal explanation? Is all I have been told about the next world a deliberate lie, or the outpourings of a highly imaginative mind? Have all the voices been Sloane's voice, and has he impersonated every individual who spoke? Has he some marvelous means of obtaining information about the deceased friends of those who come to his circle? Has he the power of knowing everyone, whether he has seen them before or not? Can he see in the dark, and, though his hands and feet are controlled, can he, in the séance room of the Glasgow Society for Psychical Research, by some means, touch everyone ever so lightly about the face and hands with the trumpet, often using two trumpets at the same time? Has he some wonderful faculty of being able to read our thoughts in the dark, and answer our questions before we have spoken them? A few simple experiments proved that this is impossible. I need not ask a question aloud, my friends in the etheric world can read my question in my mind and answer it, or tell me what I am thinking about. This often happens when I am not being spoken to. 144. I may be sitting quietly awaiting a voice to speak, and thinking of something quite apart from my surroundings, and a voice will speak to me on the subject of my thoughts. This in itself is proof positive of a personality present with powers beyond those possessed by any physical being, and it occurring in the dark makes it all the more remarkable. It might be possible for a human being, with the deductive faculty of a Sherlock Holmes, to have some idea of our thoughts in daylight, from a study of our facial expressions, but in the dark, never. Is Sloane really not in trance at all? But, besides manipulating the trumpets and impersonating voices through the trumpets, is he at the same time assuming different personalities himself, so that we have two personalities speaking which are none other than Sloane himself? I have heard 30 separate voices speaking during one seance, each of different tone and personality. Further, how can he describe so accurately the appearances of the Aetherians purporting to speak? Is it all one huge fraud, and have I and others been the victims of a great conspiracy? If it be so, it is quite the cleverest performance ever accomplished. Infinite trouble is necessary, and also considerable expense in gathering all the information, and for what purpose? Sloane's work takes him out at 7 a.m., and he does not get home until 6 p.m. When can he find time to make such exhaustive inquiries? Except on the occasion referred to in Chapter 4, he has never, to my knowledge, taken any money for all this time and effort on his part. Is he insane on this question? And for a morbid love of notoriety, does he carry on this farce? If so, why so retiring, why so anxious at all times to hide his light under a bushel? Why does he not want to be introduced to those whom he calls my grand friends? Why does he prefer quietness and being alone to holding seances, and why, from time to time, does he sign on and go for months to see where he never hears or speaks of spiritualism? I have asked myself 100 questions from time to time, in my endeavor to find an explanation. Is it telepathy? If so, how do you account for the Eric Saunders episode and dozens of others, and in any case, how can telepathy produce a voice apart from the medium? Am I the victim of hallucinations? If so, my stenographer and 145. All present are also the victims, and collective hallucination, going on for 20 years, as it has done with some of Sloane's friends, is unthinkable, as what one hears all here at these seances. Often I have heard Aetherians speaking to, and answering each other during the seance. What about cryptaesthesia, hidden memories, or the perception of realities by extrasensorial channels? Can a memory, or the perception of realities by extrasensorial means, produce a voice? Can my hidden memory, or his extrasensorial perception, make Sloane able, normally or supernormally, not only to describe correctly my deceased friend, whom he never knew, but to produce also his voice, which I can recognize, which voice tells me things I had never heard before, but found afterwards to be true? Why, if this be so, do these manifestations concern only those who have passed on, the so-called dead? Again, why does someone in etheric life bring others to speak whom you and they knew on earth, and, at times, bring those whom you did not know were his friends, but afterwards found out were so? How can a medium know normally or supernormally, not only your own friends who have passed on, but their friends also in etheria, who are your friends and theirs in this world, or their friends only, quite unknown to you until confirmed by inquiry afterwards? Nothing I can think of besides fraud or reality explains satisfactorily to me all that I have experienced. Fraud, knowing Sloane and the facts as I do, I rule out of account. The circumstantial evidence in favor of reality is overwhelming. No one has followed Sloane's actions and words, in trance and out of trance, more critically than have done, and, all these years I have known him, never by word or action has he done or said anything to make me in the least degree suspicious as to his motives. Sloane is a high-minded, upright, religious man, without much learning, and with average intelligence. A good workman, but no student. His range of literature is very limited. He told me once that he had seldom ever read a book in his life, owing to poor eyesight. I have never seen a book in his house, though I have been in every room of it, and only once an evening paper. He has not the capacity to carry on a séance, such as I have described, normally, for 10 minutes, even if he wished to do so. I dislike referring to fraud in connection with a man of such high principles, but Others do not know him as I do, and, to those who have not had the experiences which I have had, fraud is the simplest and the most obvious explanation. I rule out fraud, I rule out telepathy, I rule out cryptaesthesia. I come back every time to the only explanation which fits in with all the facts, namely, that those we thought were dead are still alive, that they have bodies such as we have of a finer texture than our physical bodies, that they inhabit a world of finer matter than we do, and that certain individuals called mediums can supply them with a substance which, when mixed with ingredients of their own, enables them again, for a limited time, to assume physical conditions, and, with their memories, affections and character unimpaired, once more hold conversations with their friends still on earth. My mind remains open for further explanations science may offer. But, so far, science has not given to me another explanation which fits in with all the evidence. In fact, science, until recently, has given little thought to the phenomena I have described. The London Society for Psychical Research has spent years studying mental phenomena, and this independent voice phenomena, equally if not more important in so far as personal identity is concerned, has never, to my knowledge, been officially investigated. It should be quite possible so to isolate the materialized mask that its weight could be taken and its construction and operation better understood. We must learn the laws governing the phenomena. There is a great field before the investigator, and I trust that what I have written will encourage someone with a scientific mind to pursue these investigations to a point which will make clear what today is obscure, as a thorough scientific grasp of the phenomena is essential. The foregoing is a faithful record of my experiences, and I have but done my duty in recording them. Some may accept them, others suspend judgment, while many doubtless will disbelieve, arguing that without deception such things cannot occur. I reply to critics on much the same lines as did Pasteur to those who opposed his discoveries on a priori grounds. In all this there is no question of religion, nor philosophy, nor atheism, nor materialism, nor spiritualism, it is entirely a question of fact. The facts are there, and refusing to face them does not alter them. If anyone has built up a system of belief which opposes these facts, that system must be changed to suit the facts, because the facts will not alter to suit any particular system of belief. Science and religion, on the acceptance of these facts, will, I believe, be united, and mankind will take an immense step forward in intellectual development, so much so that the human family will be united in a bond of harmonious brotherhood. I can now safely leave the future to bring forth cumulative evidence in support of my assertions, so that the day will come when to disbelieve in the reality of psychic phenomena will be but to plead ignorance, and to scoff will be accounted foolish. Meantime, the world is composed of those who do not think deeply on such subjects, or, if they do, are satisfied that there is nothing more to learn, and that all we can know of the universe is already known. On the other hand, there are others who have learned something of what exists beyond the veil from those who have gone before us, and, in consequence, have had their vision enlarged. As Mrs. Browning so aptly puts it, "Earth's crammed with heaven and every common bush afire with God, but only he who sees takes off his shoes." John Campbell Sloane passed on peacefully on Thursday, 24th of May 1951 at the age of 82. For nearly 50 years he put his mediumship at the disposal of humanity without asking for reward or praise. Many have obtained an outlook, and received renewed hope with comfort, because he lived. In all humbleness and modesty, he gave freely and expected nothing. 148. Appendix. 188 facts given at two consecutive sittings to Arthur Findlay. My mother died on the 3rd of February 1936, and I think that the readers of On the Edge of the Etheric will be interested to read of her return shortly after her death. This occurred at two seances, one in Glasgow and one in London. These two seances produced what I consider is first-class evidence, which came through the mediums when in trance and not by the direct voice. Not one mistake was made, everything was correct, some statements being unknown to me and found later to be correct. In both cases the mediums could not have made any inquiries beforehand, and I am quite satisfied that neither of them knew that my mother had died.